Okay, Aida, we're going to do primary financial statements.
Thank you, Hans. Good afternoon.
We have some secondary papers.
Secondary papers, yeah, we have five papers for you this month, and this could likely be the last time we're discussing PFS for maybe a year.
Don't.
And given this, I would like to set you a challenge today, if I may. So we have 2 hours allocated for this session, and the challenge is to see if we can wrap it up in materially shorter time. Gary suggested 45 minutes. So let's see what we can do. So we will start with Agenda Paper 21A, and Dehao is going to tee it up for us.
We would like to present to the Board Agenda Paper 21A on the possible amendments to IAS 34. So the Board has decided last month to issue an exposure draft as the next consultation document for the purpose of this project. The proposals in this project so far are made with a complete set of financial statements in mind. And under the existing requirements for interim financial reporting, entities may choose to present either a complete set of financial statements as defined by IAS 1 or a condensed set of financial statements based on the requirements in IAS 34. The staff has been considering how some of the project proposals that we have developed so far may be applied to interim financial report for entities which choose to present a condensed financial statement. The staff identifies the possible amendments by analyzing the interaction between the project proposals and the existing requirements in IAS 34 for condensed financial statements. A summary of that analysis is contained in the table in paragraph 10 of this paper. The staff think that some of the project proposals will be automatically applied to condensed financial statements because of the way how IAS 34, IAS 7, and IAS 1 interacts with each other. Say, for example, the elimination of the choice to present dividend and interest in the statements of cash flow. For some other proposals in the project, which might not be necessarily in line with the objective of interim financial statements being a more condensed and summarized form of financial statements, the board might not actually wish to make them a mandatory requirement for condensed financial statements, such as the proposal to add some new additional minimum line items. So the staff has identified two areas where the proposals in PFS could improve interim financial reporting for entities which choose to present condensed financial statements and where that decision by the board might be needed. The first issue relates to providing NPM disclosures. The staff's analysis on that issue is provided in paragraphs 11 to 15 of this paper. The staff would like to ask the board if it will agree with the recommendation to provide the same set of information about NPM in the entity's condensed financial statements as the entities would provide in their annual financial statements. So with that, we would like to turn the discussion to the board.
Sue.
I was very happy to receive this paper, and I agree with the staff recommendations. I did some outreach on this project recently with some investors, and this was one of the first questions they asked me. Would it be in the interim financial statements, or would they have to wait? And they said annual financials would be too long, too far apart for them. So I agree with both the recommendations.
Any other comments? Tom.
So I agree. I have a question just about kind of logistics. So it says will be provided. So is the entity to look? Because we have the thing that says if you're providing it in your external communications, then you have to put in your annual report. And so I'm sort of wondering, like, which set of external, because you say will. So does that mean I look forward to the end of the year and say I expect to put things in my external communications before the annual report, so it'll be in the annual report, so I put it in my interim? Or do I look backwards at the last annual report? And I just sort of, I have a bit of application concern, sort of which set of communications, because that's going to drive it.
How is this different, Tom, from annuals? It's the same principle.
So suppose, I made a point. So suppose it wasn't in your prior annual report, but you started doing it in your public communications around your interim.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do?
Well, the interim financial statements, as I understand, often actually don't follow the structure of the financial statements report. It's all at.
No, I'm talking about in my public communications. Say I'm a December 31 year end, so I do my earnings release or whatever it's called, and I put out a bunch of MPMs in June. That's what I'm sort of at, which communications. Does that mean, so I didn't have in last year's annual report. I put out some MPMs in my public communications in June. I have a June interim. Do I look to the fact that I didn't put in my annual report and I ignore the public communications around the interim?
Well, I think the principle we're looking at is that if it's used in public communications, we want consistency between the public communications and what we're disclosing either in the interim or the final. So I think if you were using it in your public communications around the interim, then to me, I think that complies with the principle that we were looking at. I think if what you were saying was, oh, I intend to put them in my public communications at the next year's end, I don't think that would be sufficient for us.
Yeah, because that's why I was curious. But well, so in the example I gave then, because this is slightly different in what you just described, I'm doing an interim, it's in my public communications. I don't refer to an annual report at all. I should just put it in the interim?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, I see what you mean. Does the interim...
That was my question.
Oh, okay, well, I understand.
Yeah.
Could I make a suggestion on this one? Which is, if you wrote the staff recommendation as... You recommend that the requirements for reporting management performance measures also apply to interim financial statements. If you just said that, and then I think it would probably need clarification on the basis for conclusion that this kind of trumps the general principle which you noted in the paper of the interims being the update of the previous year's annual report, and therefore if the use commences in the interim period, it would be captured. But it avoids that whole cross-referencing if you just say, the requirements for MPMs apply to the interim financial statements.
That's it. You cut them in when you begin them.
Yeah.
That's the goal. If they're important, you don't wait, to the next annual report. Just when you start using them.
So drafting amendments you're going to make to reflect what was the intention. Okay. Thank you.
And?
So also to that point, I was thinking about what happens in the 6 months before it becomes effective. So I agree with Gary. Once you start using them, they need to have the same requirements as apply in the annual report. So I would expect them to be disclosed and treated in the same way in the interim. But we're talking about an interim that has happened after effective date. What happens about that 6 months before effective date? Because some people will be using MPMs.
Next question.
It's similar. It's what we've got in the second issue on this paper, but I started once I started thinking about it for MPMs as well. So do we if somebody's starting to use them 6 months before the effective date, we're just ignoring that? And then starting from the effective date, say 1 January, it's the same issue as the subtotals.
Do you think they'll be prevented from including them? Is that...
No, but do our requirements apply or not? Because that's what we're doing in the second part of this paper, where we look at the subtotals and we say at which point do they kick in. Mm-hmm. So we just say then that the requirements for interim is the first interim period after effective date.
Correct, because the subtotals issue is a little bit different because, the drafting refers to previous annual report, whereas here I think the way we're going to draft it is... as per Mary's suggestion, I don't think that would arise.
Yeah. Okay. So it was just I thought we needed to be clear on that as well because we're bringing it up with the subtotals.
Okay.
Councillor Azza.
Well, given that the interim report is an update, I would prefer that, in fact, these changes are implemented in an annual report first. And... second, on the MPM, I agree that the reconciliation is provided, but without the tax and NCI effect on an interim basis. I think annually that's enough.
So what you're saying, Francois, is, I couldn't say opposite from what Anne said, but in a way saying that MPM is only applicable not after the first set of annuals have been published in line with the new requirements, and only then you can put MPM in interims.
I think these changes would be effective for IS 34 after after the first annual report has been provided in complaints.
Which is different to what I said, because what our conversation was, we've got an effective date of January, so June you have an interim, so then the MPMs kick in. Francoise is suggesting that no, everyone has to do a full annual, and then when there's a subsequent interim, that's when the MPM requirements kick in.
Rika.
I actually not agree with the idea to require entities to provide the exact same information as an interim financial information of the under IS 34. So, because to achieve the objective of IS 34, we need to have a good balance between the timeliness and the reliability of the information. So, I haven't had any feedback at this moment, but whether the frequency of the interim reporting is a quarterly basis, the entity only have a 45 or so duration to prepare the whole information. So in that case, it is really they can provide the reliable information about the whole adjusted effect of NCI and income tax. And also, when the implementation of this standard, maybe the second question, but I think firstly, the whole information should be provided in the annual, and then following year, the entity prepares a certain level of information of MPM in the interim financial reporting.
Nick?
I mean, this information is regularly reported by some US providers on a quarterly basis in terms of both, NCI isn't so pertinent for the US preparers, but certainly the tax effect. I worry that users will get very frustrated if they're getting different information sets at the full year and in the interims. You're subject to the rewording that Mary suggested, I'd be happy to go with the staff requirement question as set out in question one.
Okay, can we vote on the staff recommendation?
This is question one.
Yeah, 11, one absent.
Two absent.
Oh, two absent, so that would be 10, two absent.
Is that question one and two combined, or question one? Just question one.
Okay, so on the second issue, it relates to the presentation of the newly defined IFRS subtotals in the year that the amended standard is being first applied. Because of how the wording in IS 34 is being currently drafted, those newly defined IFRS subtotals are unlikely to be presented in the entity's condensed interim financial statements in the year when the PFS proposals are being first effective. The staff would like to ask the board if it would agree with the recommendation to require entities in the first year of application only to apply the amended requirements for the subtotals in the statements of financial performance as the entities would, but to the entities' interim financial statements as well.
Thank you.
First of all, I agree with staff's proposal. I just want to clarify one thing, whether my understanding is correct or not, with regard to the IS 34, or with regard to the application date. Here, the application date is January 1st, 2001. So that means from that date, the new standard will become effective. So from my point of view, automatically, the first quarter report or second quarter report will apply new standard, not the old one. So I think the answer will be very clear. Automatically, the new requirements will be, you know, applied since the application date, you know.
You're right, the new requirements of revised IS1 or a new standard would apply, but when entities for interim report, they can choose to do that, or they can also choose to prepare condensed financial statements, and if they prepare condensed financial statements, they only need to comply with what IAS 34 tells them to comply. And with regards to subtotals, IAS 34 tells them you shall have the same subtotals you had in most recent annual report. And because in most recent annual report they are unlikely to have had the same subtotals defined in the same way, this is where the issue arises. So it is just in that first year until you have had an annual report that is in accordance with the new subtotals. So it's a question of, do we want to have users wait this first year and miss, you know, one or three, depending on how often interim report is prepared, you know, or give that information 3 or 6 months after the effective date.
I agree with, you know, all the subtotals should apply as early as after the application date. With this, what I would like to say that also maybe it's regard to what's the meaning of the condensed financial report. If without those subtotals, how can we say that condensed financial report? At least they should be included those 3 or 4 subtotals. Yeah. If without that, you know,
I think the problem is that unless we clarify this point, I think people could have confusion between the requirements of ISO.
To clarify, it's necessary. Yeah. Yeah. I just say yeah. Yeah.
Mary.
Well, I really would like to see these as soon as possible. I don't agree with requiring people to adopt them for the first time in their interim financial statements. Given the potential conflict that you've had, sorry, not potential conflict, but given the requirements that you've cited that you show could prevent somebody who wanted to adopt them in their interims from doing so because of the link back, I think we should make clear in the PFS document that we permit early adoption in the interim financial statements prepared under IAS 34, in effect anticipating, but I don't want to require it. In some instances, for example, companies may have to, you know, they may need that extra time to figure out what their subtotals are going to be before they figure out how they condense them. And second, I think that the degree of change that we're talking about could be quite significant for some companies, and I want them to focus on it in the annual report with the maybe greater scrutiny that goes with what are most likely to be audited financial statements, although they don't necessarily have to be audited to be annual. So I don't support the staff recommendation as drafted, but I do suggest that we explicitly permit early adoption in interim financials if entities wish to, and remove the barrier with of the existing IAS 34 language in this instance, and not really try to at least do a one-off amendment of IAS 34 for this point.
Martin,
I agree with Mary because man should not be required but permitted, because for most entities it should not be, it should be allowed that the quarter-to-date numbers should be also the same structure as the year-to-date numbers, because otherwise it can be a complication in preparing the numbers, and therefore it should at least be permitted, because otherwise they maybe have to run two kind of structure systems, and for the year-to-date numbers and for the quarter-to-date numbers, and therefore at least we should permit but not require.
Also on that position, and I don't think it's going to delay what is brought to users, because companies are going to ask for time to implement. So if you ask for the interim, they're going to ask for an effective date that is a year later. So I think there is more benefit in having an earlier effective date that starts with the annual report and doesn't make a lot of difference in timing for users.
I agree with the staff recommendation, because I think this is an opportunity where we can help users. We make them wait for so long for improvements in financial reporting. We put it up for comment. If people come back with convincing arguments for why it's very difficult, I'm happy to listen. But on the face of it, it doesn't seem like a big requirement. And I'd be surprised if we permitted it, that many preparers are going to willingly take up the permission.
Rika.
I agree with Mary and Martin said, and I think if we disclose, I mean, if we risk, if we require the entity to disclose full disclosure, maybe it's a good opportunity for investor to see NPM new information with full disclosure of the whole financial statement. Maybe some element of NPM might be directly relating to the other part of disclosure of financial statement. In that case, a whole set of things to show the complete set of the financial statement information will be helpful.
I agree with the staff recommendation. I think it's preferable if everyone's on the new format together, not some on and some not on in the interim period. And I also thought it was in X0 that they'd be getting ready, because I think there are going to be some, it's a presentation, not a measurement thing, but we still know that there's got to be some changes in getting the information ready. So I thought they'd be doing that through X0 anyway.
And Aida, can you really split question one and two? Because if we're saying that you have to do the MPMs for that first interim period, you're going to have to reconcile to a subtotal, but we're saying that potentially the subtotal may not.
I mean, you can. I think if we don't vote for staff recommendation in question two, we're going to have a slightly counterintuitive outcome in that this reconciliation may be
different and not as logical.
It's still possible, but this is the consequence, yes.
No.
And does anyone need explaining why this is? So it's basically further to travel potentially if you don't have a subtotals, if they're not required, all you would have is potentially net profit. And then in order to comply with MPM requirements, then the only subtotal you have available to reconcile to is the net profit, which may include much more reconciling items than, say, if you had operating profit.
Or you could risk, though, that there's a subtotal that's something that management had provided historically that's not one of our new specified subtotals. So you're reconciling to a subtotal that's not comparable against other entities. So you sort of lose some of the benefits of what we're trying to accomplish with MPMs.
But then I don't think you'd actually be complying with the requirements that we have around the MPM disclosures, which would be to
Can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
In one absence. So that would be 8 in favor, 1 absent.
All right. Need it.
Okay, so that was 21A. We are moving on to 21B, Colleen.
So the board has previously tentatively decided that particular subtotals, including gross profit and operating profit before depreciation and amortization, are not considered management performance measures and are therefore exempt from the MPM disclosures. Now, Agenda Paper 21B considers whether subtotals similar to gross profit should also be exempt from the MPM disclosures. Our research included in the appendix to the paper shows that some entities use subtotals similar to gross profit outside the financial statements to communicate their performance. So such measures could meet the definition of an MPM. However, we think the MPM disclosures may not be useful for such subtotals for the reasons explained in paragraph 12. So consequently, the paper explores three possible approaches to exempt subtotals similar to gross profit from the MPM disclosures. Approach A would involve stating that any subtotals presented in the statements of financial performance in accordance with paragraph 85 of IS1 are not MPMs. Approach B would involve adding subtotals similar to gross profit to the list of subtotals that are not MPMs. And then subtotals similar to gross profit would be described in a principle-based way as typically representing the difference between a type of revenue and directly related expenses incurred in generating that revenue. And applying this approach, the board could also provide a non-exhaustive list of examples of subtotals similar to gross profit and subtotals that aren't considered similar to gross profit. Then finally, applying approach C, specific subtotals would be added to the list of subtotals that are not MPMs, such as net interest income. Now, in the paper, we suggest that the board should not pursue approach A because we think it could have unintended consequences in that it may scope out measures from the MPM disclosure requirements for which the MPM disclosures would actually be useful. And approach A may also encourage entities to include subtotals in the statements of financial performance to avoid the MPM disclosures. And we also suggest the board should not pursue approach C because it's a rule-based approach. And so the staff recommend approach B because it is a more targeted approach than approach A, which means the risk of unintended consequences may be lower. And unlike approach C, it is a principle-based approach. So that brings us to the question for the board on page 10, which asks whether the board agrees with the staff recommendation to apply approach B.
Nick.
This is a difficult issue, I think, but I think we have to demonstrate a degree of pragmatism here. It's largely for financial entities. That's what the appendix information shows us. I don't think it's going to be helpful to have lots of reconciliations of net interest income back to a defined IFRS subtotal. It's not going to help anyone. We don't have a defined IFRS metric for that particular item at the moment. So I think on balance, I favour approach B in line with the staff recommendation, but it does require us to just sort of be pragmatic in this occasion.
Gary?
I agree with Nick with one exception. I just think it's quite easy to do. If you have a natural revenue item that's an important operating revenue item, a natural direct expense item, seems to me the subtotal of those two, if it's like net interest income or net insurance, net rental income, it just makes those subtotals are going to exist. They're going to be done. The only question is, do we call them MPM and have details behind them? It's unnecessary. So in that sense, I agree with Nick.
Okay. Sue?
I agree with the staff recommendation. Again, I think it's a tricky one, but let's be practical. But I would like to avoid us saying that we recommend approach B in part because approach C, because it's more principles-based. Just because something's principles-based for me is not a reason to do it. I do agree with the specific points that you raise in paragraph 23, but I don't say that, you know, principles are always good, rules are always bad, but I do agree with your specific articulation. So
it's future-proof.
Maybe, but I think your arguments you've got here are very good, but they're much more specific than just that generic comment. And can I make a comment on the wording we're using on the management performance measures while I've got a chance?
Sure.
So if I look at paragraph 5, and I apologise if this is the wording we've had for a while and I just haven't focused on it as closely as I should have, but my understanding is that our proposal is that when management are using these metrics that aren't defined by us, that they're required to provide this information. I'm worried that the way we're wording it may make it avoidable, because if management is not that it's a complement to our defined subtotals, it's nothing to do with IFRS, they just think it's a good number. I think we're setting it up so that somebody could say, well, that's not my view, therefore I'm not in scope. So I think we just need to be careful with how we word this.
So maybe to be clear, is your suggestion then to say which complement IFRS defined subtotals and rather than in management's view?
I think in management's view makes it sound like, well, if that's not my view, I'm not in scope, you're not talking about me.
I mean, it is exposure draft, so we will hear feedback on that.
Do the best words when we go out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see your problem.
I mean, people might question how do you test complements as well, so we might get the other side of it, but I hear the potential issues. So. And all of you will have opportunity, of course, to comment on this because the pre-ballot will be with you.
I just wanted to flag it in case somebody violently objects to me trying to put that in the drafting process.
Okay, Anne?
I support the staff position for the reasons that we've already heard from the other three speakers.
Françoise?
I differ here. Personally, I would have gone for approach I, but it's probably because since the beginning I don't understand why we want to restrict so much what people do in the logic the structure of our income statement. It probably plays a role in my position. It's also because I'm not convinced by the analysis. I think I just don't understand why the tax and NCI effect are not necessary for amortization and depreciation, and all of a sudden they would be necessary for intangible asset depreciation and impairment of goodwill. And I also think that the potential for applying paragraph 85 is really very much diminished by the fact that we have this 100% analysis by nature of function. So on top of it, I know the question wasn't asked, but I want to mention that I think it's a pity that we do not specify as IFRS subtotal an operating profit before unusual items the way we have defined them, because I think that was an appropriate response to what we heard from CMAC and GPF, as having this income statement, I mean, the future income statement being a significant step back from where we are today, when in fact I think this project has a potential for big improvements. So.
Thank you. I generally agree with that, the step recommendation. However, some concern on this directly related expenses. Mm-hmm. So, if we see the example of the in paragraph 21, if we provide this kind of guidance, directly related expenses might change some kind of a calculation of this A, B, and C, D, E here. The A, B, C, D, E here seems like, you know, kind of accepted practice in some specific industries. But I'm not sure whether they are using this kind of a subtotal. They are that are consistent with our, you know, guidance here, revenue and some directly related expenses.
Are you saying that they might be then challenged that yes. their subtotal doesn't, for example, include right. all directly yeah. related expenses, and with net interest income we know that many banks use it, but it's calculated very differently, and the board is not intending to define how it shall be calculated. So, I mean, that's not the intention of this, but I guess we will hear the feedback if that is the unintended consequences. Of
yeah, our intention is not to change those kind of accepted practices in specific yeah. industries, right? Okay. So, however, it's not easy to make kind of a good guidance to let them continue use their, you know, some subtotal. For example, you know, in the case of the insurance industry, you know, for example, D, there is some kind of insurance finance expense. This finance expense can be some kind of a general interest, you know, traditional industry expense. Also, they can be include some kind of a change in fair value. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a
Yeah, maybe not that particular one, but I understand your point.
Also, I don't know. I understand that debt fee and commission income.
That's
familiar to me. What kind of, you know, this kind of a net fee and commission income is composed with some kind of revenue.
So we can describe in the basis that intention was not to define these subtotals instead, but to describe the type of subtotals that entity already use.
Yes.
That would be subject to this MPM exemption.
Mary?
I support the staff recommendation, although I did want to challenge one word in your drafting, which is if you look at the question in item B, describe such subtotals as typically representing the difference. If we want that description to be effective as kind of a control, I think we just delete typically and say representing the difference. You said a couple of times, Ada, let's do it and see what we hear back. But I would rather, as soon as you introduce typically, the question comes up about what is atypical, and you know who's in charge of interpreting that, etc. So that's my wording suggestion that as I look back on this, my concern that remained with going with B. But otherwise, you convinced me because I had started out. Maybe it's, you know, my U.S. upbringing is more in favor of the third approach, but you moved me up to this one. The other thing, going back, two other things, I think Sue's point is quite good about rules and principles. I think we should just stop saying that as generic characteristics. And I think for Francoise's point, this is an instance in which I think it would be very good in the basis for conclusion to us to identify all three of the alternatives that the board considered in this paper and what our reason was for for whichever option we end up approving, because I think that would give people a chance to consider our logic and, we'd lay it all out for them rather than having to know about this paper to go back and look at it.
So I will use Sue's approach and say the staff will propose to remove typical in drafting unless anyone has great objections. Now, I mean, you have all read in the paper the reason we introduced this word was our concern that net interest income might not make it. But having said that, we are also proposing to include examples which will include net interest income. So, that may be enough to illustrate the intention, so we can do that.
Mika.
Yeah. I agree with staff's proposal, but still, I mean, I have a sympathy with other people said as well, because gross profit term itself is commonly used already, and many management and the company have their own gross profit in their mind. So that means, there might be a certain diversity between how to interpret the directly related expense incurred in generating that revenue. So if we consider we can leave that interpretation to the practice by using their own common sense, but they really think directly related expense by using an example we give them. Is that what we are thinking as a direction?
Yeah, I mean, the idea with this is really to define the universe or help entities determine the universe of measures that are not subject to MPM requirements. I think, yes, there is lots of diversity in how entities, even if they describe these measures in similar ways, there's diversity what is included in them. And the intention here is not to define them in a way that we say these are comparable. It's for users to see what those are. And therefore, I think diversity here is not something we are addressing, but it is really that for these kinds of measures, having MPM disclosures would not provide useful information. So that's why we think the proposal addresses that concern.
Okay, can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
13, one absent.
Okay. Oh, who is next? Ken, over to you.
In agenda paper 21C, we discuss an alternative suggestion about the classification of interest and dividends in the statement of cash flows, which was made by one board member at February meeting. The current tentative decision requires an entity to classify cash flows from interest and dividends in a single section of the statement of cash flows. The section to be presented in depends on whether the entity is a financial entity, and the classifications are shown in Table 2 and Table 3 in paragraphs 10 and 14. In this regard, one board member suggested that both financial entities and non-financial entities should classify dividends received, and interest paid as operating cash flows. We analyzed advantages and disadvantages of the alternative suggestion in paragraphs 18 to 20. We think the alternative approach would require amendments to the definition of operating activities in IS 7, which would be a fundamental change to IS 7. It would be contrary to the board's decision to make limited changes to IS 7 and could cause unintended consequences. In addition, including these cash flows in the operating section would be inconsistent with the board's proposed definition of operating profit. We therefore recommend that the board retain the current tentative decisions. However, we also recognize significant advantages of the alternative approach. So we propose to describe the alternative approach and the reasons for rejecting it in the basis for conclusions on the exposure draft. The question for the board is on page 8, which asks if the board agrees to retain its tentative decisions without amendment.
Nick?
So, as the unnamed member who suggested this, I'll be brief, I promise you. So I think users will be split on this, to be honest. So some will look for alignment, which is really where we've ended, which we've veered towards with our current proposal. And others will prefer that the definitions, which are also contained in IS7, around thinking about investment cash flows, a way of deploying cash flows in things which are going to generate a return longer term. And that's really where I've always thought about this. So I think we have achieved our objective with the existing proposal and that we have eliminated options, but to me we've introduced some complexity. And so I've actually stopped talking about this a little bit with users because I've got enough other things to talk about and I don't need to get into this. The last thing I'd say, the staff have outlined in paragraph 16 some of the advantages of the approach I would follow. I'd add two further points. One would be it largely reflects current practice, largely, not entirely. And to me, given my experience with the taxonomy and trying to use the taxonomy, I think it facilitates the use of our data in a more structured manner. It's what I found. But if this can be discussed somewhere in the document, then our constituents can express their views.
Tom.
I like where we are, but I think there's good arguments for what Nick said, and there's good arguments for where we are, and I don't know why we've approached this as them being mutually exclusive. I thought about this last night. Why are they mutually exclusive? It seems to me that, first of all, we have the regular entities are all going to put it in one place. The financial entities will put it in one different place to a large degree, and they have the option of putting interest paid and interest received in the one place. And then there's some entities that will have some financing or investing and some regular, and they're going to put it in two places. So it seems to me one option would be, there's two variants on this, is that we just have a requirement for the three key items, interest paid, interest received, and dividends received, that you must provide at the base of the cash flow statement a total. Now, we could do it one of two ways. We could say, if you've put it in two places, you must do a total. Or we could say, everybody must do the total because it's really easy for people to go, if that's what they want that total number, they can go and get it in the one place. But if they want the logical subtotals that where we are, then that still exists. And that's where I don't see this as being, I think it's a small thing to put in a disclosure requirement for the necessary totals. In a reasonable way. And I think it'd also be good for the taxonomy as well, because I think in the taxonomy it'd be nice to go to something that said interest received total, if that's what you needed for your analysis. But I'm really reluctant to throw away really intelligent subtotals that I won't go into here, but I'll make those arguments if I need to, why where we are is producing some relevant intelligent subtotals. So anyway, that's my suggestion, is that I don't see why we should set it up mutually exclusive.
I think part of the reason why we didn't go for that sort of approach was the reason that we did this in the first place, which was a lot of users told us that actually they don't really care very much about where in the statement of cash flow these particular cash flows are. They just want to know where they are so that they can move them about if they need to or leave them where they are. But the big thing was we don't like the uncertainty that we've got at the moment. Give us some uncertainty about where we can find these things.
Having them totaled at the bottom of the cash flow doesn't solve the issue for me. It's exactly as Rachel says, knowing exactly where they're going to be on a consistent basis. And then being able to rework the data the way you can. But I don't feel I need to press this today as long as we allow constituents to have a view on it.
Recommendation.
Could I comment, though?
Yeah.
Because that is different what we put out. Like, if it's fine, if we want to ignore the suggestion, but then we're going to be left with an either or at the end. And I think carefully, because I think there's a lot of reasons. The whole reason we're doing the statement of financial performance the way we are is we believe the subtotals have value. And then there'd be similar arguments you can build. And I said I didn't want to go through them. I'll go through them if you want. But we're deciding whether we're going to set it up as an either or. And if we're going to vote on that, I'd be uncomfortable because I don't see why, for example, why a user can't go to the bottom to see it if he knows or she knows it's there every single time. And we're going to throw away all the benefits of the other side for that. I don't really understand.
I mean, there's already a total at the bottom. So if there is not, IS7 already requires, for example, interest paid to be disclosed if this is not part of your, you know, specific reconciliations. And also, what the board proposals mean is that it will always be in one, in a single section, even if you're a conglomerate, because that's how the proposals have been set out. You know, Nick's issue with that is that this single section may differ depending on what are your main business activities, but it will be in one section, it won't be split. And, you know, as said, we will lay out arguments for and against and explaining the basis, and we can add further points to that and then, you know, see what feedback we get. I think for us, the overarching argument was the board decision on the scope of the project being very limited change to the statement of cash flows, reconsideration of categories and the purpose of categories, and we think changing to this now would require us to do that, which would go beyond what was intended for this project, maybe not another project.
But I don't understand that. Relative to what we just said, we're going to give people a dichotomous choice. And if, in other words, if we keep what we proposed, you're saying that we're not proposing big changes to cash flow, but we proposed this version, and we're going to have another version, and they can be reconciled relatively easily. If each version alone isn't violating what we said at the beginning, why is doing one that accommodates both violating?
But if you do both, then again, you have a choice, right? And this is exactly what the board wanted to...
No, I'm not giving you a choice. Doing pure disclosure. You're doing it one way with an additional disclosure to satisfy those needs.
Doesn't satisfy those needs. I'll explain offline, but it doesn't satisfy those needs. I can walk you through it. It doesn't, unless I know where it's going to fit into the statement of cash flow, it doesn't satisfy those needs.
Okay. Perhaps you can take it offline.
11, one absent.
Moving on to the agenda paper 21D, which is the second to last. The staff recommend the board amend paragraph 17.3 of IS33 to restrict what can be used as a numerator in an adjusted EPS to amounts based on either IFRS defined subtotal or managed performance measures. The purpose of the amendment is to avoid potential inconsistency between NPM and adjusted earnings per share. We think the objective is to ensure that users receive the same information about adjusted EPS as for NPM, and all NPMs can be used as numerators of adjusted EPS, both of which can be achieved by amending the EPS standard. And we also reject some other alternatives because we believe allowing just EPS and NPM calculated on different bases is counterintuitive. Furthermore, we don't want to introduce unnecessary complexity to the forthcoming standard. So here's a question for the board. Do you agree with the staff's recommendation on how to amend IS33? Hand over to
Martin.
And I have a question because I think we have some conflicting requirements, because if a company only uses this adjusted EPS, but don't use as a kind of NPM. And we're requiring, okay, you have to use this NPM, but in the NPM requirements, we said, okay, you have only to do that if you're using this kind of NPM in your capital market communication. So if a company is not using that, I don't know how they should apply this requirement.
We have.
Because you are not allowed to then
correct
this NPM, but then he cannot have this EPS because I think it is not an NPM. So I think it is.
So
not
we
working.
Have based our recommendation on what we found in practice, and what we found in practice is that companies that have EPS would have, you know, APS.
Because it will be rare, and therefore it will not
so
be.
I think there was a Gen 1 example of company where that wasn't the case. So we thought, based on that, we expect really to see this measure, and hence we didn't see this as an issue. Although logically, as you say, this would prevent them from including it in the financials.
Okay.
Just a question: do you have evidence that when there is a regulatory requirement, that does never apply to being published in the financial statement?
Sorry, did you say that again?
But there is no regulator mandating the publication of EPS the way they define them in the financial statement. Because the possibilities that you see if there is a regulation is basically people can still publish this outside the financial statement, which mm-hmm. is fine, mm-hmm. which suggests that there is no occurrence where the regulator would mandate the publication of EPS within the financial statement.
Well, shame Darrell is otherwise engaged, because I would have bounced this question back to him. My understanding is not, but it's something to
just wanted to
confirm.
Flag that eventually.
Yes. So there is just a clarification. I think South Africa is one of the jurisdictions that requires entities to, they call it headline EPS, and it is set out exactly how it's supposed to be calculated, and they require to disclose that, to my understanding, in the annual report. And Françoise's question is, if regulator requires this disclosure in the financial statements, then these proposals would run into the problem Martin has just highlighted, and I guess this will be subject to outreach and us just making sure this doesn't happen.
Nick?
I support the staff recommendation. I think this is an elegant solution to avoid adjusted EPSs otherwise being used as MPMs by the back door without the disclosures that are required. So I think it's very neat.
Anne?
In my experience, which doesn't include South African companies, often the MPM is used as the adjusted earnings figure in the EPS, and I think that we need to address this. I don't think we can leave it and have some other number that's an adjusted earnings number that hasn't been considered within all our MPM proposals. So I support what the staff are doing here.
Can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
13, one absent.
Full circle, back to the hall.
So, having concluded the discussion on PFS proposals for the day, the staff would like to present to the board agenda paper 21E on the due process and permission to begin the balloting process for the exposure draft for primary financial statements. This paper provides a summary of the due process steps taken to date and recommends to the board a comment period of 180 days for the exposure draft. Appendix A to this paper lists out the due process steps that were performed for this project based on the requirements in the due process handbook. In summary, the board has, over the course of the past 4 years, held a total of 24 board meetings covering 66 topics relating to this project. The board has also held a number of public discussions with various consultative bodies. Appendix B to this paper provides a list of those public meetings. In addition, board members and the staff have held a total of 117 outreach meetings with various stakeholders to understand the possible effects of the project proposals. The staff have also performed research to understand the current industry practices based on a sample of 85 non-financial and 15 financial companies across different jurisdictions. Appendix C to this paper provides a summary of the analysis of the expected effects of the project proposals. So in view of the steps that were taken, the staff think that the board has complied with the applicable due process steps required for the publication of an exposure draft. And for reasons summarized in paragraphs 17 to 19 of this paper, the staff would like to recommend the board a comment period of 180 days for the exposure draft. Questions for the board are listed after paragraph 21 in this paper. The staff would like to ask the board if it is satisfied that it has complied with the applicable due process steps and that it should begin the balloting process for the exposure draft with a comment period of 180 days. The staff would also like to know, in accordance with paragraph 6.9 of the due process handbook, if any board members intend to dissent from the proposed exposure draft at this point in time. So with that, we'd like to turn over the discussion to the board.
Okay. Any would-be dissenters? Sue.
Firstly, on the positive, I agree with the suggested comment period. I think, you know, we had to make a decision whether it should be an ED or a DP, and there's quite a lot of new stuff in here for people to think about, so I think 180 days is appropriate. On the dissent, I'm a bit like Daryl earlier today. I've been thinking about whether I should dissent or not. I think on balance at the moment, I'm probably thinking I won't, but just a flag. It's sort of dependent on whether I think that the document is balanced enough. And I think there's a lot of good stuff in this project, but the one area that I feel very strongly about is on the integral, non-integral split. I'm very concerned about whether we have a clear distinction between those two things that's going to be operational, and some of the feedback we've got on a preliminary basis about that worries me. I also don't agree with it from a conceptual basis. I think if something's integral, the things that are integral are things like the sales between the entity and its associate, not the profit of the associate. So I don't agree with it as being an argument for a different location in the income statement. And also I'm worried that sort of combined with the difficulty of being clear about what's integral and what's not integral, that we may have problems with application in the sense that we may find that positively performing associates are integral and badly performing associates are non-integral, and I'm worried people will have an opportunity to play games with that. If we can get enough flavour about what some of those negatives are of the proposal in the document, I'd be happy, but I may, if not, then by dissenting I'll be able to make those arguments clear and get more informed feedback, and so that's what I'm trying to grapple with at the moment.
Martin.
No, it's not a surprise that I don't like this MPM proposals, because I think our aim is to give them more transparency and also make more clarity for users how they fit or reconcile to subtotals. But on the other hand, I'm concerned that, and I have the fear that to bringing this stuff into the financials, even if it's only a footnote, and have only audited these numbers, I think that would give them more prominence, more legitimacy. And therefore, I think people will more and more using this kind of numbers and not distinguishing what is really an IFRS number and what is an MPM number. And that is my main concern. And because I think our job is to make standards for financial performance numbers and other numbers clearly. And it is not our job, I think, to do something which is, we think, is not a kind of performance number which is required by us. And I think these numbers belong more into the management commentary. I think that is the reason, or that is the place where management communicates their think about performance. And then it is a job of the security regulators to make requirements, okay, if that is appropriate or not, and if they have to reconcile to financials, that is not our job. I think it is SEC or general security regulators' job. But overall, I'm concerned because this brings more prominence, legitimacy, and confuses maybe not sophisticated users, but we have also more many retail users. We have other people with using financial statements. But I have not finally decided if I would dissent, because on the other hand side, we have so many good stuff in this ED. And I have looked at that because I have to think, okay, what is the positives and negatives, and I have not finally decided, but I have to say I have to read really the draft on the ED before I can make a final decision. But I think that this was not a surprise that I always have raised these concerns about the MPMs, and I'm still struggling with that.
Mary?
My comment is much more focused. I am not thinking about dissenting on this one. It's about the comment period point, which is, having had the long discussion, relatively speaking, this morning about rate regulated and what are the circumstances that drive us to go for more than 120 days on an exposure draft. We seem to just be kind of saying, yeah, 180 days, that's great, let's go on this one. So they're both exposure drafts, and I don't I don't know if we average them and take 150 for both, but while there are a lot of pieces and the staff has done, just incredible credit to you in terms of how much you've marshaled together into a very coherent document, these are not as challenging conceptually in most circumstances as some of the other things that we're consulting about. I'm just not sure that we need 180 days from that perspective. And I'll use the fact that I'm speaking today. I wanted to say particular thanks for the way you've done the outline of the effects analysis in the draft here. I thought that was very good backup to have for the permission to ballot request.
Well, I mean, unlike with the rate regulated activity ED this morning, we intend to publish this at the very end of the year. And we need to leave time to prepare us to test the proposals and really analyze them and see. And when I say prepare us, I'm thinking of all practitioners because, I mean, auditors are busy as well. So to me, this...
this is a timing issue for you?
This timing is necessary.
Anneli, what were we saying about timing on rate reg?
Rate reg will be coming out end of Q1 2020.
Okay, so that's the difference.
Yeah, and the other thing to bear in mind is that goodwill is expected to come out at the same time as PFS. So a little bit of cushion helps.
Okay. Well, we have talked about possible dissenting. So who can agree with comment period of 180 days?
13, one absent.
Okay, and permission to ballot?
13, one absent.
All right. Very good.
Thank you very much. Well done. You have achieved the target as well, in materially shorter time.
Congratulations.